Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Economy might be struggling, political future might looking bleak, but on October 27th, all skepticism aside, at least for one day, people will join to celebrate country's 25th Independence Day in Turkmenistan with much of fanfare. But the question is, other than 25 years of its existence, what else people are celebrating? What have been the achievements and disappointments of the past two decades? On today's Majlis, Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, we will discuss Turkmenistan's past and present and connect the dots to examine what future holds for this energy-rich Central Asian country going forward. To discuss the subject, from Washington, I have Victoria Clement, research scholar at Woodrow Wilson Center, who is one of the few Westerners who ever lived in Turkmenistan. Victoria, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. From England, Dr. Luca Anchesti, chair of the Central Asian Studies Center at Glasgow University, is joining us, who is the author of book on Turkmenistan's neutrality. Dr. Luca, welcome to the Majlis.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Ruslan Matiev, editor of Alternative News Turkmenistan, an NGO which is based in Europe, is joining us. Ruslan, welcome to the Majlis.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Very nice to have you. And Bruce Panier is joining me today here in Washington, D.C., who's the editor of Kishlak Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. Bruce, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you. Good to be in the studio with you again.
Very nice to have you, Bruce. Before to take on, let me remind you, please feel free to amplify, expand, or disagree directly with points other guests are making. Please don't wait for me to prompt you with a question so that we have a lively chat. Ruslan, let's start with you. First of all, happy Independence Day.
Yes, the same to you.
Thank you. And I know you must be a kid when the country called Turkmenistan came into existence. What are some of your earliest memories involving the independence?
That's a good question. I was actually six years old back then. And my earliest memory of Turkmenistan's independence is huge crowds of people standing in line to buy bread, to buy flour, and basically other very basic products.
Bruce, you were all around in Central Asia those days. How were things under Soviet Union, and how did it change overnight when the Soviet Union collapsed and several countries became independent?
Well, I would say, first of all, that I wasn't there actually when it was part of the Soviet Union, but I was there just a little more than half a year after it became independent. And at the time, strangely, it seemed like Turkmenistan was probably one of the more stable of the countries. There was hyperinflation in Russia and all the other Central Asian republics, too. It was affecting them. A lot of uncertainty, a lot of things that people didn't know about the system. But, for instance, when I would go to I would be in Moscow and I came to Turkmenistan, and the price of bread in Moscow was 5 rubles. It was 50 kopecks in Ashgabat, and price for gasoline at that time was about 45 rubles a liter, but in Turkmenistan it was 5. And they seemed to have their act together a lot better than the other countries. Over the course of time, that changed greatly. But there was, in 1992, in the first half of 1992, it really looked like that country had a chance.
It's a really grimy picture, Dr. Luca. And then when Niyazov started announcing this, that he's going to make Turkmenistan a second Kuwait or something, wasn't that in the early days of independence?
Oh, absolutely. It's 92, 93. All the rhetoric that we've seen, you know, the Halkbatan Turkmenmash and all the sort of rhetoric about the regime, were all established in 92 and 93. The time were a time of great expectation. I mean, I can't really remember those days in terms of, I mean, I was still younger than even university then. So it seemed to me that looking at that retrospectively, the first 5 years were probably when the politics were more stable. It was very much authoritarian, but not as idiosyncratic as it is now. And the promises of the Kuwait, sort of, if you want, objective of the regime, were very much predicated on the fact that Turkmenistan was the biggest winner of the old former USSR when it came to adjust the prices of gas from the Soviet prices to the market prices. There are statistics that show that Turkmenistan won the states that benefit most from the sort of adjustment of the price system. And, you know, those 5 years were, as the guys who were there or visiting there just confirmed, were a time of hope. There's not much left of that, but I guess we're going to get into later on.
Victoria, you remember these days, right? Niyazov's announcements comparing Turkmenistan one day to be a Kuwait. Listening to some of our guests today, the situation was really not even near to Kuwait. But was he genuine in his promise in those days then?
Was he genuine in his promise in that with that picture? Yes. I think that Niyazov believed a lot of the rhetoric that he spouted, whether it was the fact that there was going to be a computer in every house, a car in every garage, yeah, or that Turkmenistan was going to be the second Kuwait. This, what he promoted, I think he believed to some degree.
Then what went wrong? He slowly stopped mentioning Kuwait. Maybe then he realized that it's not going to happen, or he had some change of direction, change of mind. What happened?
Oh, I think change of direction is the right way to put this. It wasn't so much that he lost the dream of second Kuwait, but the form of government started to change. I mentioned that I was there early on. I was there when they dragged Lenin out of the Central Park, and then I went back a couple months later, and they were putting up a statue to Niyazov, yeah, and this was really... You know, later, latter half of 1992 was the part when this cult of personality started to develop in Turkmenistan, and it had taken firm root by the spring of 1993, and I think that was when the country really started to change its direction. It became less forward-looking and more inner-looking, and with Niyazov being the center of everything that was happening in the country, and that was a downfall.
Okay, what is the defining moment which led to this change of direction? It's open for anyone who wants to take this question. Ruslan, maybe you wish to take it?
Well, I would like to go back to the question if he really believed it. I think he really believed it in the beginning of the years. At the same time, I do not... exclude the possibility that it was just a populist, you know, message to the people, that the people were largely not happy with the collapse of the Soviet Union, because that meant for them insecurity. Basically, the totally completely new country came across. And just to, you know, to satisfy the people's feelings and emotions at that time, this big statement was made. Now to your question about what went wrong. Turkmenistan is a clan country. It's a tribal country with very many different powers, with many leaders back then. And everybody basically wanted a piece of Turkmenistan, a piece of that wealth. Later, corruption took over. Basically, this all these processes have led to the fact that Turkmenistan did not turn into Kuwait, not even close to it. So,
Can I just add? Yes, for me, a critical moment. I mean, there are many, but one of them could certainly be when Niyazov dismissed Abdi Kuliyev, the first foreign minister, in August 1992. When he did that, he assumed control on the foreign policy as well, and we noticed from then on the decline into this neutrality, which became a synonym for, if you want, isolation and insulation, whatever you want. But it became a very passive foreign policy. So when the president got to control that sort of machinery as well, it is pretty much the same idea that was behind the metaphor of the statue that Bruce Panier mentioned before. He put himself at the center of policymaking, and the policy had to serve what he needs to do to stay in power. And that's the beginning of the end.
Victoria, then there was an event in November 25, 2002, when there was apparently an attack against Niyazov. What effect it had going forward in Turkmenistan in terms of Niyazov's policies, the way the country being ruled, and all these things?
Well, I was there at the time, and it appeared that that was an actual coup attempt, and the effects of it were to increase the isolation of the country, because the outsiders were implicated, or people who had been living outside of Turkmenistan were implicated in this, and it led to a deterioration of relations between Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, and it made life much more difficult for those people in Turkmenistan who are non-ethnic Turkmen, as things became even tighter for them.
Interesting.
Can I just say, you know, you asked about a defining moment of change or over the past 25 years. And I think that what I was just saying about the difficulties for the non-ethnic Turkmen relate to what I see as not necessarily a defining moment, but a definite process of intensified Turkmenification in the country. So one thing that we saw under Niyazov that continues under Berdimuhamedov is this intense tying of political power to Turkmen culture. And we see that in education, in public space, in iconography. And this is something that definitely did start in the 90s, but really intensified in the 2000s, almost becoming what I like to call a Niyazovization of the culture.
Let's talk about a little bit on some of the milestones. Announcing it is neutrality was one of the such major developments in Turkmenistan. Dr. Luka, you did a book on that. So what were some of other major steps that Turkmenistan took over the past 25 years?
I mean, for sure, neutrality it is. I mean, 1995, that's one of them. Mm-hmm. It's one of them, especially because it achieved that sense of legitimacy that having a UN declaration on your own status was actually part of what the regime has sought to do in the early 90s. That's for sure. It's a landmark, if you want. Another landmark for sure is the 2002 coup, and probably the next one would be Niyazov's death in 2006. But neutrality is particularly important because it is a symbol that stays until now. It is a symbol that continues to sort of influence how the state is portrayed internationally, is presented to its own citizens. And we see it in the Afghan problem at the border. Neutrality comes to be invoked many times. So that's probably one of the key events on the 1990s, yes. But another one could be the Constitution, 18 May 1992. I mean, that's the first one in the post-Soviet world. And you couldn't think of a worse place to have sort of a democratic sort of document being signed than Turkmenistan. But that's another symbol, if you want, of the corruption of the institution later on.
I would like to add into this, I think it's important, in 2001, the release of Rukhnama, which supposedly was the milestone for the revival of the Turkmen nation, of the Turkmen language, culture, and celebrations, etc. As Victoria mentioned, for the non-ethnic population of Turkmenistan, this was also one of the symbols for the fact that, okay, it's not going to get any better. It's time to pack suitcases and leave.
Bruce, you want to say something?
Yeah, just one more. I would also add in 2001, too, the post 9/11 events and the immediate aftermath showed Turkmenistan that it could be on the doorstep of major world events and still not be forced to change the system that it was developing inside the country. And so I think that was a big moment for them in terms of building confidence in the leadership that they wouldn't be subject to outside pressure that would force them to change their course.
I think the other major development was also when Niyazov decided to remain in power for a lifetime. What was the circumstances that he came into this conclusion? What's the next question?
Well, I suppose I could just throw in real quick. He had extended his term in office already, and I believe they were supposed to have elections in 2000 for presidency.
Yes.
But he got around that because he held a big meeting. I think it was the Halk Maslahati at the time, which was fairly recently formed before that, and they decided after appeals from people in the audience that they would just bypass this process and either make him leader for life or president for life. And there was this big ceremony at the very end of the year where he had appeared in a white robe and was given the palm staff, which are, of course, signs of the Prophet Muhammad, and it was declared by unanimous consensus there in the hall that he would be the leader for life for Turkmenistan and they would never need to have a presidential election again.
You know, you mentioned this, Bruce, about the Turkmenistan's strategic location after 9/11, the place that it's sitting. From other point of view, what makes Turkmenistan important is that its energy resources. So there was a real opportunity to make Turkmenistan Kuwait, and there was a real opportunity to benefit from the interest that international community was developing in Afghanistan after 9/11, but there are some missed opportunities. What were they?
Boy, if you're asking me, then I would say the one was that Turkmenistan has just refused to let outside people come in to develop their resources, except for China more recently. But that's where they really missed the opportunity. They were so afraid of foreigners being in their country that they decided they would handle all the gas business themselves to the greatest degree possible. And now we see what they've got, which is nothing. You know, you can compare it to Kuwait, but Kuwait had a port, which is a huge difference. And Turkmenistan doesn't, and they were going to have cooperation from outside actors, and they never thought that it was necessary, and now we see the results.
Mm-hmm. About the missing opportunities, any other comment?
Yes, there has been a huge missed opportunity with education. The first major education reform in 1993 called Bilim was the start of a reduction of education in the country. And as Ruslan said, the introduction of the Ruhnama that was introduced into the curriculum of schools as well as public life. And while there have been some improvements, some reforms under Berdimuhamedov, there is still a great deal of room for improvement. And with 46% of the population under age 25, there is a great pressure on education.
Right. Thank you very much, Victoria. Just to recap the debate today on the Majlis, we are discussing Turkmenistan as past 25 years and looking into what does it say about its future. Discussing the subject with me are Victoria Clement, Turkmenistan expert and researcher at the Washington-based think tank Woodrow Wilson Center, Dr. Luka Ancisci, chair of Central Asian Studies at Glasgow University, is joining us from UK, Ruslan Matiyev, editor at the Alternative News Turkmenistan, is joining us from Europe, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog is today here in Washington, D.C. with me in the studio. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. So we come to December 2006 when Niyazov died. With him, his golden age era also gone, and Turkmenistan entered to Berdimuhamedov's era, which he later called era of supreme happiness. When Berdimuhamedov took over, there were few early signs of thaw and positive changes. Let's recall some of them, Ruslan.
Well, basically, he restored the 10-year education, which was greatly appreciated by the society, because that reform of Niyazov has led to the fact that hundreds of thousands of young men and women were deprived of the right of getting good, proper education overseas, because everywhere else, even in Kyrgyzstan, I studied myself in Kyrgyzstan, the minimum requirement for secondary education was 10 years. So Berdimuhamedov basically revived the 10-year system, which was good. He promised to introduce internet to the Turkmen society, although I should highlight here that even under Niyazov, internet was available to the population. I remember me being a small child and visiting internet cafes, actually, right by my house in Dashogus, and they were privately owned. That is also very important, because now under Berdimuhamedov, yes, he opened internet cafes in all major cities and even in rural areas, but they are owned by the state. No private men, no private businessmen are given, this right to run an internet cafe.
Mm-hmm. Talking about some of the positive changes, Bruce, I think although it's symbolic that Berdimuhamedov also reversed some of the bizarre practices of Niyazov, especially the names of the months being restored, names of the days, or what was that, day being restored?
Yeah, all that.
Yeah.
How
significant were they?
Well, it was good to see that he was trying to bring Turkmenistan back into the real world. Niyazov certainly in his last days seemed to be removing it from any kind of reality that we're familiar with. And these renaming of the months and the days of the week and things like that were just part of this, where they were like so some alternative universe or something all of a sudden. So I suppose we can credit Berdy Muhammadov for helping to re-standardize some of the basic things in Turkmenistan.
Obviously, things later went a little bit into different direction, but we also need to keep in mind that what he inherited from Niyazov was a disaster, a dysfunctional administration, one-man administration. Despite all this in early stages of his leadership, I should say in Turkmenistan is standard, as you, Bruce, were saying, Berdy Muhammadov at least, reversed some of those Niyazov's disastrous steps. But what happened later? Again, he went back to Niyazov's direction, Dr. Luka.
Well, it happened that he opened a pipeline to China and he got confused between the loan and investment. So in that sense, he pretty much made sure that the single source of revenue that the country had was not bringing the same amount of money that it did before. So in that point, which is the system in which we are now, and we've seen that when the economy is getting worse and worse, it has to go more authoritarian. It has to become more, if you want, focus on the cult of his personality. In fact, we saw a couple of years ago when we were hearing stories of strikes in Lebapelayat and food riots here and there. What did he do? He built a statue of himself and he put it in the middle, in the center of Ashgabat. So, in that sense, is the economic situation deteriorating so much that brought him to be becoming as authoritarian as Niyazov was, as sort of erratic as Niyazov was. And we've seen this also in the way in which he deals with his own elite. He's sacking people left, front, and center, the average tenure of ministers and governors in the region is becoming very similar to what used to be after 2002. So we see now a repetition of some of the most authoritarian tactics that Niyazov had, with the difference that now the economy is really on the verge of disaster.
Interesting. Maybe, Victoria, you want to take this question. In case of Niyazov, we discussed, he started nicely. Also, Berdy Muhammadov, he started nicely, but something happens on down the road. Is it the person himself, or it's the system, or there is anything else which influences this change of direction later?
I'm not sure I can give a definitive answer to that, because I think it's probably a combination of things. But one thing I do want to highlight is that we're talking a lot about the system and the government, and the Turkmen people have been living through all this. And I think that despite the problems that we can point out and the disappointments that we can highlight, the Turkmen people have shown some real tenacity and resilience over the past 25 years. And you mentioned that, you know, I had lived in Turkmenistan, and if it hadn't been for the hospitality and openness of the Turkmen people, I wouldn't have been able to do that. So I would say that although we can continue to talk a lot about the regime, the people have been holding on, and I think show some promise.
Right, obviously. They are surviving despite all these difficulties. Ruslan, a Turkmen, when was that when you said, we are again in the same path?
It's hard to give a certain date, but these signals, these signs emerged slowly. And after each of them, I would think, okay, this is temporarily, this is going to end. But no, unfortunately, it did not. Well, first of all, the appearance of his portraits everywhere throughout Turkmenistan. When Niyazov died, I was in Kyrgyzstan, but the following summer, I went back to my homeland for the summer break, and it was quite noticeable already. You know, the portraits of Niyazov were replaced by the portraits of Berdy Muhammadov. The new slogans of the new era emerged also. Basically, it was a change another phase. The system remained, the old practices remained, but the face has changed.
That the sign on the door changed, but the message stayed the same.
Exactly.
So we are comparing Berdy Muhammadov and Niyazov. So one of recent steps by the Berdy Muhammadov to amend the law clearly puts him in Niyazov's path for lifetime leadership if he wants. First, is there any optimism that he might not stay forever, Bruce?
No, I think only mortality will remove him from office, to tell you the truth. I don't see, you know, and in fact, they're going to hold presidential elections next year. And I know a lot of people have pointed to that as kind of a hopeful symbol that at least they feel the need to go through the motions of this. But considering the dire economic situation in Turkmenistan, I would prefer that they just name him leader for life at this point and dispense with the expense of having to go through this charade, you know, it's going to be every 7 years now because they changed the constitution, but it's pointless.
Interesting. Comparing Berdimuhamedov to his predecessor, I mean, Berdimuhamedov named himself protector, I believe, a bigger title than Niyazov's Turkmenbashi. That means only the leader of Turkmen that he liked to be called. Also, I think there has not been any major change in situation of press freedom and freedom of expression in human rights under the current leader compared to Niyazov's era. As we speak, one of our own reporters, Sapar Mehmet Nepeskuliyev, remained in jail since last 1 year. Just this week, I believe another Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty reporter in Ashgabat has been intimidated. Her camera was confiscated, and several other reporters of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Turkmen service were forced to stop their work for Radio Free Europe recently. And of course, Turkmen authorities continue to refuse accreditation request by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, to open its bureau in the country. So in this sense, I would say even that developments have been worse than Niyazov's era. So Ruslan, you are working on a project which requires information coming from Turkmenistan on a day-by-day basis. What has been the situation of press freedom under Berdimuhamedov compared to Niyazov's era?
Well, I would take Berdimuhamedov's last few months, so to say. And there's a clear picture that the situation with freedom of the press, freedom of speech, has worsened. For me, it began somewhere late July when the cotton season began. And as you know, since 2013, I'm conducting forced labor monitoring with the help of locals who travel with groups of people to the fields to pick cotton. And unfortunately, I cannot give names now because I'm not allowed to by their families, so to say. There were cases when a few of my men were arrested and detained for taking photos on cotton fields. And one of them has recently been released, but at the same time he served 10 days of administrative arrest. Unfortunately, other people have not been released, and now they are facing criminal charges, of course fabricated. More than that, I noticed that the Turkmen security services, after their chief was reprimanded by President Berdimuhamedov on October the 4th, I believe, have gone crazy, so to say. They monitor people living in Turkmenistan and those who are negatively commenting on social media, who like critical articles or photographs. They are taken to police stations, they are being interrogated there, and some of them are released, but after profilaktическая беседа, that they call it, after speaking to them basically and you know, lecturing them that, you know, this is no good. But unfortunately, some of them have not been released, and they are also facing criminal charges, and in the coming days I will release one of those reports about one woman. She's 62 years old. Her only guilt was that she commented an article about the fact that Ashgabat city officials are forcing residents to paint their windows, to darken their windows. She commented that article. She was quite open in her words, in her opinions, and for that she suffered. She's 62 years. She's ill and has no relatives except her husband. And for the past 2 days, I have not been able to reach her husband either. And that really worries me, and I hope that this will be resolved soon. Mm. On another matter, I had to ask, I had to seek help from Human Rights Watch, and they were very helpful. They called one of the animal rights activists in Ashgabat, and clearly let her know that they are aware of her situation, and if anything happens to her, that they will make a big fuss out of it. And I know that some Western diplomats were also involved in this, and they also visited her home and made sure that the security services that were watching her, tapping her phone, etc., they made sure that they heard this, they saw this, and only thanks to this, this woman is still in safety. Mm-hmm. But again, she's at home, she cannot leave. People who visit her or people who call her, they say, okay, there are unidentified men standing outside of your place, so please don't come out. Don't go out anywhere. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the situation.
Yeah, now we are really, really talking about the effect of those policies on real people. Earlier, Victoria, you wanted to draw our attention to day-to-day life of ordinary people here. Ruslan, you said that these pressure being intensified over the past few months, right? Mm-hmm. What is the reason, in your opinion, behind this?
I believe the reason is the great amount of information that comes out of Turkmenistan, the great amount of opinions, comments, and just the engagement of the Turkmen citizens on social media, on the internet. This all cannot worry the officials, because people express themselves, people say what they feel, and their feelings are not good, you know, in relation to the government, and that cannot worry the regime, and they had to take some action on this.
Interesting, despite all this pressure, people are still talking about this. One of the other elements that I think it might be relevant to talk about here is the Turkmenistan's, you know, downsizing economy might has to do something with this pressure.
And absolutely.
Dr. Luka, you mentioned earlier that Turkmenistan is, you know, passing through one of its difficult days these days in terms of economy. What do you would like to add in this aspect?
No, I'm just saying that I fully agree with Victoria. This is about resilience.
Right.
But I really come to question now how long more can these people be resilient? Because from what I understand, the economy is in a very sort of tragic situation. I even heard people that told me that they are getting no revenue at all from the gas they're selling to China, which makes me believe that the whole economy is pretty much just supported by the little flow of capital that comes from Iran for those two shorter pipelines. I mean, gas is 85% of what Turkmenistan makes in terms of revenues. It's the biggest budget line. So when you cut so much of this entry and you rely only on two small pipelines, it seems to me that there is not a lot of money coming in. And that is becoming not only a problem for the people, which, you know, of course, is the most important issue here, but also could be a problem for the elite, because less revenues means that you have got less, you as Berdi Muhammadov, you got less power to buy people, to influence people, just to corrupt here and there. So you will have to have, you will see in time, a comparative downsizing of the regime as well. It will be becoming more and more narrow. And that, for me, would be the event that would bring Berdi Muhammadov to the same context when Niyazov was after the assassination attempt, where he basically was less and less trust, so he didn't trust his elite anymore, and became more and more withdrawn, getting to the point that Bruce made before about the fact in the last month, last few months, he seemed to have lost the plot. So I would not be surprised, especially if those forces that say that the gas, the revenues from China are simply not coming in anymore, that we will see a shrinking economy, a shrinking regime, and an more unstable, if you want, political landscape, despite the fact that now we know it's going to be present for life.
Okay, shrinking economy, shrinking regime. Another development which, contrary to this theory, is taking place in Turkmenistan these days are mega projects, Bruce, multi-billion-dollar projects. How to make sense out of that?
Well, unfortunately, we've seen this, you know, for pretty much almost all of Turkmenistan's history, and since they now lack revenue, since there's not much else they can do. People see that the situation is changing for the worse around them. So in some ways, this is a weird sense of continuity. that if they can pass this off as like, look, it's business as normal, there's nothing to worry about, and here's one of the signs that, that the situation is the same and that we're in control, is that you're seeing the same amount of these image making projects, you know, that really serve almost no purpose at all, but at least it shows people something that they're used to for all the 25 years, pretty much all the 25 years of Turkmen history, so the Turkmen government can say things aren't that bad. You see that that everyday life carries on in some respects as it always has. It's pretty sad. And I would just add in one thing with the economic situation going down. And I'm sorry, there's not a better way to put this, but the Berdi Muhammedov is kind of reaping the rewards of 25 years of repression. If the economy was failing and deteriorating in almost any other country in the world, as it is now in Turkmenistan, there would be serious social problems. But after years of citizens being monitored, thrown in jail for voicing alternative opinions, it's very hard for the Turkmen people now to stand up and say, my life is getting much worse and I can't take this anymore.
I wanted to talk also about the health sector, which is another disastrous situation, especially when you consider Berdi Muhammedov, who was a health minister earlier, and he is a doctor by profession. And also wanted to touch about the foreign policy of Turkmenistan over the past years. But we are getting out of time. But again, I don't also like to end this discussion with such a pessimistic note, Victoria. You lived in Turkmenistan. You spoke to people. You know this local sense. So tell me, based on all these points that you have, imagine for a second that you are Berdi Muhammedov. And tell me, what is your biggest achievement under the last two terms?
Oh, biggest achievement. Probably, in his mind, it's probably these prestige projects that Bruce was talking about. But the biggest need that he faces, I think, is the economic situation overall and this persistent need for jobs. And with this incredibly high number of people who are so young, that's not going to fade away. So the economic situation certainly dominates the scene.
Anything that Berdi Muhammedov can be proud of in terms of his achievements, Bruce?
Well, he's got some big bank accounts in Germany, as I understand.
Come on. There should be something to say. Come on.
Well, his repeal of Niyazov's education programs was a step in the right direction.
I can answer this question, if I may.
Please.
I'm Berdi Muhammedov. I'm proud of the fact that I eliminated drugs in Turkmenistan, despite it was at high cost, despite so many innocent people were also, ended up in prison like Mansur Mingelov. But many people are thankful to him for this, because I remember late 90s and early 2000s when drugs were so available and so cheap. 15,000 manat for a dose of heroin was nothing. That would be my greatest achievement. Also, the fact that my country borders Afghanistan, not the most stable place on earth. I managed to keep Turkmenistan away from radicalism, away from bad guys, basically.
Okay. To build on this achievement, Dr. Luka, if you would be the advisor to Berdi Muhammedov, what would you suggest him to do tomorrow?
Well, the first thing he has to do, he has to start giving access to foreign companies to the onshore gas field. In that sense, you start to have the economy start to grow again, and he can then implement all the health reforms, all the education reform, all the social reform that the country desperately needs. So we discussed this a couple of times in the podcast, Mohammed, and it seemed to me that the situation has become now unsustainable. And when you cut the biggest sort of source of revenue, you simply cannot do anything in terms of economic policy, planning, social planning, and health and education. So to reverse the trend, which is becoming pretty dire at the moment, I would just open up the country and then eventually you start to put the money where they should be, which is, as Victoria rightly said, education and health.
Let's hope that to be the case. Thank you very much, Dr. Luka Enchesci, Chair of Central Asian Studies at Glasgow University. Also, thank you, Victoria Clement, Turkmenistan expert, research scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, for being part of the Majlis today. Ruslan Matif, editor at the Alternative News Turkmenistan, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being part of the Majlis today.
Thank you, Mohammed.
Thank you very much. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.